Take a network break. Grab your virtual donuts and head to the nearest underground bunker with no Wi-Fi and no internet because nothing and nowhere online is safe. I'm Drukhan Remari. With me is Greg Farrow. This episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team skills up to date. Visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30, and that'll get you a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. This episode is also being sponsored by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. Sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers, and you can monitor 3 locations for free, and of course, choose a ThousandEyes t-shirt. And hey, stay tuned after Network Break for a Coffee Talk interview with John Smith. He is the co-founder and CTO of Live Action. We're going to talk about network and application visibility, service assurance, and why these factors are essential for companies that are adopting SD-WAN. And that's coming right up at the end of this episode. All right, to the news. We're going to start our march of security shame with a story from Reuters reporting that HPE allowed a Russian security company with close ties to the Russian military to review source code for ArcSight, a security information and event management product.
Okay, so, you know, obviously these big companies, especially governments, do code reviews. If you're big enough and ugly enough, you can convince vendors to give away the secrets of the mountain and so forth. But giving the security technology to the Russian government hasn't been the smartest thing that somebody in the sales team did this year. Obviously, HP sales wants to sell something, anything. Doesn't really matter what it is. Customer wants to verify the product. Sales rep went, money's money. The government wants to look at it. We did the same thing for the U.S. government. Why wouldn't we do it to the Russian government? Lo and behold, the Russian government now has the source code of an app that's used to protect the U.S. government. And now it's like everybody thinks that the spooky parts come in and, you know, the woo-woo, the black helicopters and the vans and all that sort of stuff. Well, now the Russian government's got the source code. They can look for vulnerabilities in this app and start lighting up the U.S. government because now they know what the source code looks like. And I think ultimately, it's a storm in a teacup. I mean, this looking at source code has been going on for 30 years. Why is it suddenly a problem now?
Absolutely. And I think, just to be clear, HPE, on their part, they say that the source code review took place in an HPE facility outside of Russia and that no code left the environment, but they did let them look at it. But I agree. I feel like this is a tempest in a teacup. You know, it sounds like, oh, they've got the keys to the kingdom now. But I did some looking up a CVE vulnerability database. There's been problems with ArcSight for years, a variety of issues. And that's the same for every piece of software, every piece of hardware that's ever been released.
Yes. ArcSight's been consistently awful for 15, 20 years.
And frankly, if a foreign government or a nation state wanted to get its hands on the source code, they have other ways besides asking for it. So,
yeah, but it's cheaper just to get your enemy to give it to you.
Sure. It is cheaper. It's a little more, yeah, a little less effort on your part.
Remember, a lot of policing, just a lot of things that happen in policing are just done that way because it's cheaper. It's exactly like a corporate environment. There's a lot of things that happen in security, like in terms of breaches, is it's often just the cheapest way to do something, which is exactly the same as what happens in business.
Right. I mean, I can see why Reuters, who broke the story, made a big deal out of it because the optics are terrible given the current relationship between the United States and Russia and the current state of our security infrastructure where everything seems to be open to everyone everywhere. So yeah, it doesn't look great, but this whole notion of security through obscurity, if we just can hide it from the enemy, then we'll be safe. We all know that is also BS. So yeah, there's not a lot here.
There isn't. I mean, if they did secure the access, like Russia didn't get the source code, they just got to do a review in a secured facility and didn't get, they haven't got the source code sitting in one of their own servers somewhere where the KGB can say, oh, thank you very much. I'll have one of those. But I think the flip side here is that we're now seeing the outcome of these overheated sales cultures. So companies like IBM and Dell and HP and Cisco are not actually technology companies as much as they are sales machines, right? The job there of these salespeople is to go out and find a lead and crunch the deal, close the deal, find out what it is, get over the objection, just make it happen and get the money in through the door. And they treat the whole thing like a game. It's not like there's ramifications or problems with this. And I think we're starting to see the other side of overheated sales cultures where, you know, they're increasingly desperate to make deals, to keep those numbers up, to get the profits going and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And they're starting to make glaring errors. And we're going to see a lot more of these. I think the same thing's happening in Facebook, you know. We just take money from anywhere because we've got to hit the bill. You know, we've got to justify our valuation. So just get the money in. Don't do any review. That's cost. We don't want cost. We just want money. Automate the heck out of that. So it's get the money, cheapest cost, whatever it is. And no, we don't do that. We don't want to, you know, Facebook's furiously trying to pretend it's not a media business, and it is. There's lots of stuff going around, you know, Facebook's trying to defend itself. But most of what it's trying to defend itself from is exactly this. They're all about sales. They're all about the money and getting it for the least possible cost. And if they have to start doing review, or it slows down the business, it slows down the growth and blah, blah, blah.
Or they actually have to say no to somebody's money.
Yeah, which is going to kill them, right? You know, so bad that, you know, they're only like, didn't exist 10 years ago, and now they're one of the biggest companies in the world, as if a bit of a slowdown wouldn't do them any harm. Bah. This is the downside of overheated sales cultures. They start doing things for the money, not for the right reasons. And I think HP Enterprise has been caught out here. Now, of course, this particular product has been offloaded to Micro Focus because it is a turd and it should be gotten rid of. Nobody should be using it. If you've got it, you should be thinking about how quickly you can migrate to something else.
Yeah, this was scrapped by HP last year. In fact, they did a whole divestiture of a portfolio of older software products, and ArcSight was one of those they shunted off to Micro Focus. So now it's Micro Focus's problem. And I think Micro Focus has said that their policy going forward now is that troublesome governments or worrisome governments won't get source code review, and any source code review that does happen has to be signed off on by the CEO.
Now, think about the secondary impacts of that, right? And maybe we'll talk about that more later on in the show. That's a real issue. Let's push on.
Yeah, so I just want to say that I feel like this is less a story about InfoSec, and it's more about corporations having to decide who they're willing to take money from. You know, a repressive government, a known dictator, an autocrat, somebody with a poor human rights record. If you're going to take the checks and then suddenly they're using your packet sniffers or whatever to persecute people, you can't be like, I had no idea they would do such a thing. You've got to decide if you want the money, you sort of buy into the complications that go with it. All right, moving on. After the HPE story broke, Symantec CEO sat down for an interview with Reuters to declare that his company would no longer allow source code reviews by any government.
Didn't he actually say that he stopped them years ago?
Apparently, this was a policy that came forward in 2016, but I think he, or probably his PR folks, said, opportunity here, go call Reuters and let's get a sit down and put some patriotic stamp on Symantec. Hey, we won't allow this kind of thing.
Yeah, except they probably did until they realized how much it was costing them. Like, setting up these source code reviews is actually quite expensive, and you quite often don't get the business, right? So again, it's about, you know, a lot of this stuff is a bit futile and pointless as far as I'm concerned. But in this case, I think that Symantec sort of just, as you say, score some cheap marketing points because they took it away, and probably took it away for the reason that I just said, which is it was hard to do, probably wasn't selling much to Russia, and the cost of setting up, you know, the inspection was just beyond it. So, you know, we just can't have this much cost in terms of sale. And I think you're going to see a lot more of this where the cost of a sale is becoming important because companies can't afford to waste hundreds of millions or tens of millions in a bid to make money anymore. It's got to be cost effective to sell.
Yeah, the moral position that Symantec is, I think, trying to shade here is a little bit undercut by the fact that they actually don't do a lot of business in Russia anyway. And so it kind of takes away from their pedestal on which they have placed themselves.
And not to mention how much of it was just stolen, like pirated software anyway. So even if they went over there and did some stuff, they'd probably just get pirated, especially if you get a look at how, you know, get into the licensing code for Symantec. What would happen then? So I don't think that's a big deal. I don't think Symantec, at the end of the day, Symantec is not really a viable security company. It's very difficult to believe that Symantec, even now, I mean, remember a few weeks ago we were laughing at them because they couldn't even run a certificate authority properly.
Right.
To the point where Google has actually taken them.
Right. That's right.
That whole piece of the business that Symantec used to own, but sold very hurriedly because obviously their reputation was taking a hit. You know, if you can't run a certificate authority properly, then convincing me that you can run a virus and a malware engine or any other security software, it just doesn't make sense.
No, sure doesn't. Mm. All right, another story. More details are emerging about the compromise of Kaspersky antivirus software. We talked about this a couple of shows ago. They're being apparently manipulated by the Russian government. According to a story in the New York Times, there's new details. Israeli intelligence operatives discovered that Kaspersky software was being exploited and then alerted their U.S. counterparts to say, hey, you might want to look into this.
Well, in terms of finding a backdoor onto as many people's machines as possible, antivirus apps is the ultimate backdoor, right? The evidence put forward in the New York Times and in the Washington Post is really damning. It suggests that at every level, the Kaspersky products were compromised enough and were actively siphoning off material. And what probably has happened here is that the Kaspersky software was detecting NSA malware or foreign government malware, and it was being siphoned off to the Russian government via Kaspersky. But I do actually wonder if it's being done as a covert operation in the company employees. Like, it's possible that Kaspersky management or executives were not actually collaborating with the KGB. There's no evidence of that. And Kaspersky himself, Eugene Kaspersky, has actually been well-liked and well-trusted in the community. But that doesn't mean that his internal organization isn't compromised. But the Israelis definitely hacked the Russians. They definitely saw KGB fingerprints all over the actual operations. We've now got a problem where the US government is now rapidly moving to get Kaspersky out of all of its operations. And I think most foreign companies will get rid of Kaspersky. And that, I think, is going to lead us to a pretty difficult situation for many companies about where do you buy your security software from?
Yeah, it seems like it's really now becoming an issue of you just have to buy native, because what can I do about the software from another country that there may be some nation state issues going on and I don't want to bring that onto my system. It's getting very strange.
Well, if you think about it, at this point, once it's been done for national or state secrets, it's also very easy to turn this around and start doing it for industrial espionage.
Oh, sure.
You know, Russian companies could be targeting people to take away their business ideas or their intellectual property. And once you're in the antivirus, you can get anything you want. It's just a case of sifting it out. Now, it's also possible that the Kaspersky app was just – there's another possibility that's happening here, which is where NSA employees or NSA contractors, not NSA full-timers, and the NSA, a lot of these spy agencies rely on contract staff, but they don't get quite the same level of screening. They don't have the same level of discipline. And it's possible that some of those were actually taking stuff home from the NSA, like yep. keeping a copy of it at home because it was cool or they wanted to play with it or whatever. There's some people just have this, you know, kleptomania about software that they see at work. They want to take it home because. And perhaps Kaspersky software was actually detecting it and then it was then being used to compromise these people. So it's entirely possible that there's been a concerted campaign by foreign actors to actually hack NSA or US contractors. Now, of course, I actually fully bet that US is doing the same thing to Russia and China, by the way. So but the US stuff is, you know, this is actually being, has been come out in public, open society, freedom of the press. So we actually hear about that. I imagine that the US is also doing the same thing potentially with Symantec, you know, or any of the other antivirus tools.
Yeah, this is the thing. When the US says we can't trust foreign products, then foreign markets will say, well, we're not going to trust your products. And then it goes round and round and we're all, you know, not buying from each other. And we've got these stalemates and it's just a very... you've got a note here about how this leads to essentially poor development of software because essentially you've got a captured market. Yep. U.S. companies know that nobody from overseas is going to come in and try to beat them at business. And apparently Kaspersky was doing that because there are a bunch of government agencies that now have to yank Kaspersky off their software.
That's right.
It reduces the degree of competition.
This goes back to where we were 20 years ago, where the U.S. government and U.S. companies were only allowed to buy U.S.-made products.
Right.
And they ended up with second-rate hardware and second-rate software because the U.S. suppliers didn't have to compete on the global basis. And they ended up with these cozy backroom deals, you know, like heads of companies like IBM executives would talk to US government people and they'd say, we'll make you the software that you need and don't you worry about that. And here's the price tag. And the US government went, very good, off you went. And then, you know, we saw the Koreans and the Japanese come along and make better computers and better software and faster everything, right? And ultimately, we went to a global system and believed that security could be analyzed or tested. And I think it's just what we're seeing in IT is just too much focus on cheap profits. This idea that why would I test my software? Why would I validate that it's actually up to date? Why would I make sure that it's working? You know, I have to do all these costs and these due diligence and people just aren't doing it. They're just going, oh, global trade, buy whatever. But think what happens now if Symantec can only sell to the US market and Kaspersky can only sell to the Russian market and, you know, Europeans only start buying European software. Where does that leave us in terms of these products? A lot of these companies have built up infrastructures based on global supply chains, and they need to detect viruses that are happening globally. They can't just rely on the viruses that are detected in a particular geography. So there's going to be a real problem here where if this continues, if this balkanization continues, you want to buy the best in the world, but when the world wants to spy on you, how do you buy Russian software if you're in Great Britain?
It's a tricky, tricky balance, and I don't have any idea how to strike it.
No, and I also think it's also a chance for cheap politics again.
Always. There's always a chance for cheap politics.
Yes. And of course, you know, it's going to bring jobs back to our country if we kick all the Russian software out. And the answer is probably not, because the Russians going to kick out all the US companies as well, and it's probably going to come out about even or worse, you know. So there you go. So just think about the secondary impacts. It's, you know, these things have secondary impacts. Obviously, if you are an enterprise and you're running Kaspersky, you need to think about getting it out of your system ASAP. You need to start working away to replace and migrate away, because industrial espionage.
And there we are. All right, quick break to tell you about our sponsor, IT Pro TV. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. You can get the most current IT training with over 2,000 hours of content and more than 125 hours added weekly. And Greg, you can tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so you can stream all of their courses live and on demand. I'm a huge fan of this. This idea of going away to a training center and being yelled at by somebody for 40 hours in a week is actually going to learn you something. I think it's a pretty obsolete way of doing things. That's what we did back in the 80s and the 90s, but hey, it's 2017. It's time to move forward. You can stream these things to your favorite media, Fire TV, Apple TV, iOS apps, so you can watch them wherever you like. IT Pro TV is continually updating their calendar and their courses. They're doing Linux, CyberOps, CompTIA, and all those sorts of things. And you can make sure your team is ready to fight off the latest cybersecurity threat with their team solution, which provides group pricing and access to the IT Pro TV Supervisor Portal, which gives you full control over your team's training schedule. So if you're a manager, you can see what your team is watching, how much they're doing, whether they're getting through it, and you then actually know where they're going. You don't want to get on a plane and go to places like Las Vegas, where you become a target for a fun, you know, a fun-filled evening, you know. Maybe you should be sitting at home and doing these things where you're right next to the pub. In fact, why don't you take IT Pro TV to the pub?
Hey, there's a whole line of advertising they have not explored yet.
I think this has got real...
this has got legs.
Got me thinking about what I'm going to be doing straight after the show. So what you need to do is go to itpro.tv/networkbreak. That's itpro.tv/networkbreak, and use the code NETWORKBREAK30 to try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. So 30% off for the lifetime if you keep signing up. To learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution, sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal at itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30.
All right, on to the news. In the least surprising news ever, The Guardian reports that the Deloitte breach is likely wider than the consulting firm initially disclosed. When the breach was first announced in September, Deloitte assured the press that only a, quote, limited number of customers were affected. Now The Guardian says that emails for at least 350 government and corporate clients were exposed, though we do need to note that it hasn't been confirmed if any information was actually taken.
I told you so.
You did. You did.
I told you. You always announce small so that the press sort of goes in. So you hope that nobody picks up. And now
drip.
Yeah. The whole story is apparently they migrated into Microsoft's Office 365 server in Azure, and they left some servers lying around which were just on the internet, unprotected, unfirewalled, and a little bit of password hacking would get you admin rights to those servers. And apparently people have been rummaging around in there and stealing the email for the whole of Deloitte's. So now they're still trying to work out who was breached and whatever. So, but what you do is you always announce your breach early and then announce just a little bit. So I really wasn't much a prediction. It was pretty much guaranteed. These people have been in Deloitte's mail servers for, I believe it's over 6 months.
Right.
So is the current estimate. And it could have been much longer. So, yeah.
Yeah, to say limited, just it smacks of disbelief. But we can only go on what they say. They're calling it limited. They're the ones who know. But this Guardian story is raising some red flags.
Well, you know, when you've only had a few days to discover it, it's only limited because you've only done a limited amount of discovery. It's all semantics and marketing. It's rubbish. I think Deloitte has been pretty badly penetrated. Very embarrassing for them. And I think increasingly people need to realize that big companies are actually your worst security provider, because they're just actually not very well disciplined. While one person in a big company can be quite talented, or even a few people in those companies are quite talented, the vast majority of them aren't actually very good at all. They're just big company employees who do whatever they're told and they follow the playbook, and that's it.
Yeah, and Deloitte isn't the only consulting giant with egg on its face. The Register has a story about how someone at Accenture, that's another giant consulting firm, left 4 AWS S3 storage repositories open to the public internet, and these repositories contained, quote, gigabytes of files from internal emails to login credentials, as well as cryptographic keys, all in plain text.
So Accenture's sitting there looking at the Deloitte breach and going, we got to get some of that. Hold my beer. I'm going to have a bigger security breach.
How can I get my name in the media?
That's exactly right. I mean, all press is good press, right? This breach looks worse than it is. Perhaps I don't want to make a prediction on this one, but it looks like several gigabytes, like several hundred gigabytes of Accenture data was left in an unsecured S3 repository, which has got a whole bunch of stuff in it. A preliminary analysis by a white hat hacker suggested that there's keys there, there's emails, customer information, a whole lot. There's no way of knowing whether how much of it's been taken. And of course, Accenture's doing the usual thing where you announce early, you announce limited impact. And I think we'll hear more about it in the future. Pretty, pretty bad. And ultimately, I think this is showing you that the cloud is at least as insecure as any enterprise IT system. Don't move into the cloud thinking it's more secure. It's just a different security model, which actually makes it harder.
Well, it tells me that just because you're going to the cloud doesn't mean you leave behind all of the practices that you have for on-premises. You still have to...
Actually, you do because, yeah, when you move into the cloud, all of your existing security practices are based around the infrastructure you have in your private cloud or your private data center. When you get to the public cloud, it is all different. The actual down-on-the-ground tools, everyday, you know, what you're doing for scanning, what you're doing for policy and process, all of that is actually different on the ground. And that's why these things are so problematic, is that a lot of people just sit there and say, we'll just take our existing security stuff and move it out. We'll put a firewall in front of it and blah, blah, blah. And that's not the same at all. It's not even remotely. When you go to the public cloud, you have to basically develop a whole second security team just focused on public cloud security, because it is that different, in my opinion.
I guess what I'll say is that in my perception, the cloud providers put the tools in place for you to use to put in basic sensible protections. It's up to you to take advantage of them, to deploy them, use them properly, but they're there. Make an effort to do it right when you go to the cloud.
Well, I think the real challenge here is that, like, once you drop, how do you control your S3 buckets? When you start doing your scanning, like when we do scanning on enterprises, we're just scanning a known set of IP addresses, checking the emails and blah, blah, blah. When you start putting stuff into S3 buckets, your scanners actually don't work in that situation. So you have to update your scanning strategy. Do you actually have control of all the accounts that are on AWS? This is entirely possible that, you know, some business unit just took their credit card out and signed up to an AWS.
You're absolutely right. Yes. Yep.
So this is where this, you know, shadow IT starts to come unstuck. Someone's just shoved the data up there and said, I'll fix it tomorrow. But even more likely, I mean, to be quite honest, the identity management solutions in AWS and Google are just abysmal, like, and Azure, by the way, are just really, really difficult to work with. They use weird language. They don't use standard infrastructure speak. They create their own terms for their own stuff. They don't speak languages that everybody else speaks. So when you get there, it's not obvious how do you go about, you know, keeping this secure. And for a lot of these people, they are supposed to be experts. So they can't actually go and say, we need an expert to help us to do this. I think there's much more of this stuff to come. We're going to see this stuff going on for years and years and years because it is actually quite difficult.
All right, last but not least in our roundup of security faceplants, it wouldn't be complete without a visit from our good friends at Equifax. The inestimable Brian Krebs of Krebs on Security writes that Equifax's credit assistance site, which consumers are supposed to use to get a copy of their credit reports, was serving up malware.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously if you've got a music major and you're the chief security officer, you're probably meeting what people expect of you. There's still no signs of even the most basic IT competency from Equifax here. They can't even set up a web server at the right level. We've seen a string of things like the websites continue to just fall over just for the load. They can't even put a website up under load. And when they do, it seems to be immediately hacked by somebody else. And in this case, it was being used to serve flash malware, like a false flash update.
Right.
Immediately, not 2 weeks down the track or 6 weeks down the track, immediately that it went online. The website itself was badly, the certificates that were done, the website couldn't stay out. It's just like, is there anything Equifax can do right in terms of technology? It seems not.
Well, what they are good at is shifting blame, because they are blaming the incident on code from a third-party site that collects website performance data. And Equifax also says it has removed the malicious code, but wow, just one stumble after another.
It's still their responsibility.
It sure
just
is.
Because
absolutely.
Using a third-party service, you should have done the security due diligence. You should have validated the site. You should have done a security analysis on this thing. That is schoolboy errors, literally schoolboy errors.
Yeah, it's pathetic. All right, some non-security discussions. Cisco has announced version 3 of ACI. One of the big takeaways is that Cisco has released software in this release so that you can do multi-site management, meaning that you can connect data centers via layer 2 as long as those data centers are running ACI fabrics.
So a couple of things I noted about this, obviously the ability to be able to do multiple data centers, and a lot of them, not just two
right.
or four,
yeah.
Like 250 odd of them or more.
Yeah.
And they've also finally scaled ACI up to a size where it's actually usable for most people. So that is, up until now, version 1 and 2 has been quite limited. You can't do lots of things, and they keep promising that features are coming. So 4 years in, 5 years into ACI, we've finally started to see it get reached the promise of what they promised us back. But the first thing that leaps out to me here is, have you noticed that suddenly ACI is intent-based networking?
I have noticed that, yes.
So I think it's very telling that after the campus came out with intent-based networking, ACI has been forced to fit in with the campus networking. It's important to remember that ACI was originally designed around the computer science theory of promise theory. And this is very different to the way intent-based networking should work. If you're basically building an app around promise theory and you're building an app around intent-based networking, now neither of Cisco products are genuinely designed around what I would believe to be an intent-based network model of computer science, of software design. And I think they're going to come a cropper because competitors are always going to be better than them because, once again, Cisco's taking whatever it's got lying around and slapping a different label onto it. So SD Campus uses Lisp and uses a proprietary encapsulation of Lisp, and then it creates an epic layer over the top. But Cisco ACI is completely different. It uses VXLAN encapsulation and custom silicon and custom hardware and restrictions all over the place so that you can't actually do what you want. And now they're going to give them the same label is going to be kind of confusing. They need to converge these two products in a hurry. Customers don't usually see these as two different things. So, you know, I don't think this is changing the labels on the jam jar is going to be much of a thing, although I don't think they'll call ACI new and improved because now it's got intent-based networking on it, because that would be an admission that the last lot wasn't very good. I noted a research report this week that pointed out that ACI and NSX both have about 40% of the SDN data center market. And I don't think that ACI is really going to make much of a dividend in this because NSX also has the multi-data center. You really can't talk about ACI without talking about NSX as well, in my opinion, because everything they do is kind of neck and neck. They keep coming out together. And NSX has been doing multi-site for much longer than Cisco ACI. So I see this as a catch-up in terms of competitive placing. I dug into sort of what ACI is doing here. And I think, you know, ultimately the gap between ACI and NSX is still, you know, one is software-centric and ACI remains very hardware-centric. And when you go over to their website and you read up the customer stories, they're still very much focused on this. ACI is a good way to replace spanning tree.
Oh, wow.
And we give you some good visibility into configuration so you can actually see what's configured in your data center and some promise around automation in the future. So sure, ACI does things like endpoint groups and, you know, you click this and click that and it goes and does all the configuration. But I don't see a lot of that as automation, or if it is automation, it's sort of like the first level of I wrote a post this week about a taxonomy, the 5 levels of intent-based networking. And I think ACI is kind of like a level 1. It's like a self-driving car, like cruise control. You know, it just...
Yeah. That's a long way from a cruise control to a self-driving car, yes.
Yeah. So a couple other things about the announcement that struck me is Cisco is making a big effort to regain control of the data center conversation by talking a lot about its integration with Kubernetes. They talk a lot about, you know, they've got this new agent, which they're pushing out there, and they're saying ACI is going to be able to work with Kubernetes to configure all of your network together. What it doesn't say is how are you going to control your VMware VMs? And that's a massive gap for Cisco. So while Cisco can talk to the VDS using the APIs that VMware makes available to them, Cisco's almost completely stopped talking about how it's going to weld VMs into Kubernetes, you know, into your legacy stuff, your stuff that's in the fixed. So what struck me, and here's the question I wrote, is can Cisco be seen as a network strategy for messy the Kubernetes ecosystem? I don't think so, because I don't think developers who are working in Kubernetes think about connectivity the way Cisco does. What they think of networking is load balancers, proxy sidecars, DNS, DHCP, and they don't really care much about the features that are in ACI at this point. So Cisco's got a long way ahead of itself to be seen as a leader in Kubernetes network strategy because they're still not focused on the things that people who do Kubernetes are doing. I think Cisco's definitely making the right move here to move into Kubernetes, but whether they can get ahead of the Kubernetes ecosystem and be positioned as a serious player there. I mean, I think Contrail's much stronger in terms of developers' minds because they've been doing this for much longer and very much a software company, whereas Cisco's still, you know, dragging its hardware along behind it. And I think DevOps people sort of see that. They don't get the messaging that Cisco brings across. Cisco needs to get away from this switches and custom silicon if they want to be in the public cloud of the future. They need to be seen as a software company, and I don't think they're doing that quite right yet.
Well, I would say that, I guess from Cisco's perspective, they would think developers shouldn't care about the underlying network. They should just have network services available to them, and then we'll handle that on our side with ACI, and the network engineers can make sure that They've got the templating and the automation and the hooks that they need into that Kubernetes environment to provide the networking that a Kubernetes-based application is going to need. So I don't know that they need to attract developer mindshare. I do agree that they need to be fully engaged and on board with Kubernetes if they're going to be part of the application discussion, you know, 3-5 years ahead. But yes, they have some work ahead of them.
And the Kubernetes discussion is a software discussion.
Yes, yes, very much. Right? Yeah.
It's not I have to buy Nexus 9000s or I have to migrate from Nexus 7000 to 9000.
You're absolutely right. Yep.
And I'm not sure that Cisco's quite embraced that to the point where it's going to make inroads. It really needs to stop saying, you know, we've got these cloud scale ASICs, we've got this, because as soon as the DevOps people go over and try and work out how ACI works and they see this, they're just going to switch off and turn around and go somewhere else. I think Cisco's made a, as I said 5 years ago when ACI sort of arrived on the scene, I still think Cisco's made a glaring error in terms of putting this, making it hardware dependent, and that's becoming more and more apparent. They really should have just made it software only, but they decided to make it hardware integrated so that they could make short-term revenue, and I think that's probably coming home to roost.
Could be. All right, another quick break to tell you about our other sponsor for today, ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. And that's a problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. So here comes ThousandEyes. They can give you visibility into every network your company relies on. That's the corporate network, the internet, your cloud service provider network, and you can see it all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. And together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. And how can that help? You can piece together multiple layers of network insight from BGP routing and DNS to web servers. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems like device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, route leaks, and more. And you can share this data and insights with vendors and customers so you can resolve problems faster. And here's an offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/Packet Pushers, and you'll get a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see. Back to the news. Dell has announced that it's creating a new business division to focus on IoT. The VMware CTO, Ray O'Farrell, has been tapped to lead this division, and Dell says it's going to invest $1 billion over the next 3 years for R&D.
That's not much.
Oh, you just threw cold water all over that announcement.
I do think it's right that Dell has to do something in the IoT space. But if you look at General Electric, they spent $12.5 billion investing in IoT to build a platform off of its existing customer base. And then recently they just abandoned that entire effort. They now have a $4.5 billion IoT business. But basically what it does is the IoT business monitors power plants and other things that GE is doing. It was trying to build itself into an IoT company that everybody else would want to talk to. It was going to become like the de facto IoT company. And it spent, you know, $12.5 billion building out that business, and now it's dead. So if Dell's going to spend $1 billion, that's like Cisco's Intercloud. Do you remember when Cisco came out with Intercloud and said it was going to spend $1 billion building out Intercloud, a public cloud solution? And yeah, I think if you want to be seen as an IoT company, you need to be thinking about a $10 billion investment in the next 3 years. I mean, Cisco's further down this path because it got the Jasper technology. So it has this IoT platform, and it's desperately out there trying to convince other companies to put their IoT edge devices and use the platform that Jasper has, you know, as the software back end for all of that.
Right.
You know, Cisco paid $3.5 billion for that business.
You see this as sort of a less than firm commitment from Dell with this $1 billion pony up.
Yeah, I think, you know, $300 million a year for R&D, that's like amateur hour.
Okay.
That really is. That's not significant in terms of, you know, what other people are spending to build out these businesses. Cisco, you know, like I said, these IoT businesses, these platforms that are out there, they're changing hands at like $5 to $10 billion for established businesses. Dell needs to go and buy one of those and stop futzing around with R&D. That's like, we don't know what to do, so we're going to do some research and development.
I think I did get that sense from the press release that what they're saying is they're looking around at all the pieces they have in their own portfolio, and they're saying, let's glom some of these together and call it IoT, and we'll, you know, put some architecture around it, and we'll throw in some AI and machine learning language, and everybody will buy it and we'll be happy. So yeah, I guess I kind of am getting the sense that this is a place they need to be. They're trying to figure out how to get in there. $1 billion sounds like a lot to me, but I take your point.
Yeah, this is play money. Dell is a $65 billion company. They need to be spending. IoT is just going to be the future for all of these companies. PCs are dead. Servers are dead. the idea that you're going to buy printers from Dell or storage arrays from Dell as growth market, IoT, Dell should be announcing a $20 billion spend over the next 5 years to build an IoT business, not $1 billion in research and development.
That's true, but they also have a lot of debt to service, so maybe they can't put that kind of money up at this point.
Well, who knows? But, you know, I take your point, but I think that Dell could certainly go to its private investors and say, this is just window dressing. I'll bet they'll spend 10 or 20 million doing some research and development and go, oh, IoT, that's pretty difficult. We'll skip that. And that's it. It's just done.
All right. We'll put that in the prediction file.
Sure.
We're moving into financial reporting season, and the first one out of the gate is Barracuda. They've got their Q2 2018 fiscal year results. Quarterly revenue is up 7% to $94.3 million. Subscription revenue is up 14% and now accounts for 81% of the company's total revenue. That is pretty impressive.
Yeah, with a 90% plus attach rate. So that is everybody, 90% of people resubscribe. Although that means you lose 10% every year, which is kind of like, interesting. What was interesting about this is that their forward predictions were actually quite bad. So the share price is down, I think, 15% after this, because security companies are supposed to be increasing, not decreasing.
There's certainly a lot of talk about security.
Yes. So the market punished them quite badly there, as they lost a whole bunch of stuff. And rightly so, they shouldn't be decreasing. So the shares dropped from $26 to $22 almost immediately after the announcement because the forward projections were quite bad.
All right. Wall Street wants results now and in the future.
Well, the security market is seen as actually happening and being on fire. It shouldn't be, you know.
Right. Yes. I see that. Yes. Projections should be up.
Yes. If you can only produce as predicted, you shouldn't be in the game.
Our last story for the day. A couple of shows back, we reported on how a Microsoft data center in Ireland had to resort to running on gas-powered generators because the local grid was tapped out. Now the website Engadget has a story about how Microsoft has bought the rights to 100% of the energy that's going to be produced at a wind farm in County Kerry, Ireland, over the next 15 years. So they just rocked up to GE, which owns this plant, and said, we'll take the next 15 years worth of energy you produce.
Yeah, now this is something we've talked about a lot. I keep saying that public clouds have now reached a size and scale where you can't just, all the easy things are done. So your ability to put 80,000 servers in a big warehouse, and you probably optimize the heck out of that. And now all of a sudden you're going like, well, I need to build more, but there's no more power left in the grid. And how do they cool it? So they came up with some cooler, fun ideas. And so this is the sort of thing that they're now doing, is they're now actually having to sign 15-year agreements.
It's an amazing agreement, 15 years.
Yeah. So effectively what they're doing is buying power stations to power the Azure data centers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those sorts of things are actually substantial liabilities. And so the cloud companies are actually finding it much harder to continue going forward. So this is the sort of thing I predicted, is once you get to a certain size and a certain scale, you actually start having challenges that are unique, and costs rise exponentially in this situation.
That's right. Microsoft is experiencing this firsthand. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Don't forget, we have live action coming up. But first, Greg, where can folks get more from you?
People can find me microblogging on ethereummind.com. More serious writing at packetpushers.net/archive, actually. For some reason, we use the word /archive on packetpushers.net, and that's where all of the news and blog posts are. So if you want to just catch all of the news, packetpushers.net/archive. And of course, I've been topping up my snark levels on the Twitters at Ethereal Mind, having loads of fun this week with
that. That's right. Yeah, go check it out. And I'm Drew Conramari. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and Thousand Eyes. And please stay tuned for our Coffee Talk with Live Action. That's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk. Today we're talking with Live Action, our sponsor for this segment, about SD-WAN visibility and assurance. Our guest is John K. Smith. He is co-founder and CTO of Live Action. John, welcome to the show, and let's start with the little elevator pitch about Live Action and what you guys are up to.
Yeah, sure. So Live Action is an enterprise software company, and our goal is really, you know, simplify the network for our enterprise customer, and especially the digital enterprise, because, you know, they rely so much on the network. And we basically look at deep understanding of the network, all the way from the edge of the data center, campus branch, to endpoints, and the usual stuff, you know, continuous insight, the application performance, service assurance, and control. So that's kind of our elevator pitch.
Okay, so you're collecting information about network performance to give folks an idea of how their network is operating and where potential trouble might be.
Yep, absolutely.
So to get into the conversation, we're seeing a shift in the industry where, quote unquote, software defined, it's moving out of the data center and into the WAN. And you have some insight on what's driving this shift.
Yeah, so SDN has been around a long time now, and we see it shifting into other areas, and I'm sure your listeners are seeing it as well. But it's basically SaaS, cloud adoption, hybrid IT, they all play into it. And I think it just provides a lot of different options of doing WAN connectivity. Now, a lot of our digital enterprise customers, they see the need and requirements for connectivity back to the cloud, whether it's for their SaaS or public cloud access. In the old days, they would backhaul everything back to the data center and then send it back to the internet. But that doesn't work anymore because of, you know, performance issues, you know, having to, you know, haul all that traffic back. So they want other options, I think. And all of the, what we see is on the branch side, you know, providing different connectivity. But also, it's also about, you know, having the agility as well. So, you know, speed of bringing up sites, reducing operational costs, and just managing WANs in general just gets complex.
Yeah, and SD-WAN has definitely taken off here because it does allow you to, if you want, dump traffic from a branch right out to the internet rather than, as you say, backhauling.
Right.
And you also get more performance analysis. You can split your traffic across different pipes if you have them. A lot of benefits there. But just to be clear, Live Action isn't an SD-WAN play, but you help folks extend the value of the SD-WAN.
Yeah, so we're a multi-vendor SD-WAN monitoring tool, meaning that, you know, as you purchase different types of SD-WAN systems, typically you go with one, but we can actually analyze and help you understand in the context of your bigger network. So that's kind of what we do.
Okay. So when we talk about initiatives around software-defined and SD-WAN, and now we're hearing more about intent-based networking, does this mean essentially starting from scratch, throwing out your existing infrastructure and building up from greenfield, or is there a way to do more of a hybrid approach?
Definitely, there's a hybrid approach, and different SD-WAN vendors, you know, have, you know, different deployment models there as well. But for our customers, you know, we see them trying to maximize their existing infrastructure as much as they can, the existing routers and switches. The edges changes to some extent, you know, virtual edges or virtual CPEs. As they adopt these new solutions, they want to be able to, you know, maximize what they already have. And Cisco is such a big vendor here. I mean, their strategy is, you know, building SD-WAN on top of their existing infrastructure. And similar vendors are doing that as well, where they have a presence in the WAN edge. They'll add additional functionality to provide SD-WAN capability. So we're seeing a lot of that. But we also see new vendors with, you know, hardware or virtual appliances that you have to put at the edge. Some are overlays on top of, you know, the existing WAN fabric. So we see people trying to, you know, leverage what they can. But, you know, some of the vendors do require new gear.
So there's going to be a mix, you're saying?
Yeah, definitely.
And you mentioned Cisco. I know Live Action integrates its network performance monitoring products with Cisco. And these days, Cisco is obviously also all in on SD-WAN. They've got their own IWAN platform, and they recently acquired Viptela. What do you think is the reason for Cisco's investment and attention in this space?
Well, Cisco has a large market share in the WAN enterprise networking, so they definitely want to keep their leadership. And Cisco is well known for, you know, doing acquisition, you know, throughout the years. So I don't think that's a big surprise. But when you look at SD-WAN in general, there's so many vendors, like 40 vendors in there. But when you look at that space, like Viptela is, you know, a pretty clear leader in terms of revenue, technology. And we've actually been partnering with them, you know, prior to this acquisition. So we've worked with them and we really like their technology. It's very easy to deploy. But I think for Cisco, you know, it fits into their DNA strategy. And because Cisco customers that require, you know, large scale, ease of use, now they have another option, I think. And their goal is to make it work with the Cisco gear in terms of like integration. So I think it all works good for Cisco.
So if my organization is considering a software-defined environment or SD-WAN, what are some of the major challenges?
Yeah, so I actually wrote a blog about some of these, but you know, one of the things is, you know, can you see the entire network? So a lot of SD-WAN vendors, they provide management capabilities, but it's really for their platform, right? It's not the connectivity into it, for example. So having the ability to see more end-to-end, the WAN, the LAN, the wireless, the endpoints together with the SD-WAN, you know, makes it a lot easier for troubleshooting and debugging. And especially, you know, as these large enterprises deploy these, they really need to be able to see that. And the second part is, you know, can you plan and get the right information? So, you know, can you get the intent, the applications, the bandwidth utilization? I know everybody's doing, you know, intent washing right now, but that's coming. And also at the end of the day, as you, you know, apply this intent, can you validate and make sure that the application performance is correct across this very complex network?
So it sounds like a key here is visibility. It's, you don't just want to have that insight into what's going on across your WAN. You've also got to tie in your LAN, your wireless network, and all these visualization points.
Yeah, and the solutions that the SD-WAN vendors provide is great for their portion, but you know, you really need a network analytics platform that can scale, do historical, do troubleshooting, do workflows. So you know, we see our customers coming back to us and asking for these capabilities as they deploy.
So this is probably then a good time to turn the conversation specifically toward live action. How do you fit into the picture? What are the key value propositions you guys are bringing to the table?
I think it boils down to like three propositions. So simplicity, visibility, and scale. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But simplicity, first aspect of that is, you know, is it easy to deploy?
And is it easy to deploy?
Yep, it is. So, you know, in the old days, installed software, things of that sort. But, you know, we have a virtual appliance and we've put a lot of effort into it. So very easy to update, very easy to deploy. Also, you know, you can spin this up and add additional resources, cores, memory, as you scale your environment. But part of that deployment is really, you know, with our large enterprise customers, it's a very distributed footprint. So can you be able to deploy and work in a large WAN type configuration? So, you know, we put a lot of effort into that portion of it. And the other part is like making sure that part of simplicity is validation and assurance of, you know, what you design is actually what's being operated on that network.
So how do you get that validation and assurance? What are you doing there?
It really actually comes to some of the visibility pieces of it. Like, are you integrating with the controllers to get information? So for example, the controllers have a lot of data in terms of, you know, deep packet inspection to find out the signatures of the different applications. And then on top of that, they have a lot of performance information that we can gather. So part of that is different vendors use different technologies, but they do active passive monitoring of the applications. Some use BFD, which, you know, your audience probably heard about. And it's really measuring jitter, latency, and loss across that network on an application basis, which is really good, rich data. And I've shown this to our customers. And for the service provider community, it's really going to shine a light on what their performance is, because 24/7, these SD-WAN networks are monitoring exactly what's happening on their WAN on the cloud. And then we can gather that data. So when you're doing your analysis of the capacity analysis or service provider performance or SLAs, we got all the data for them.
So you provide sort of a watchdog mechanism for folks who are depending on their service providers, the kind of what they're actually getting, what they're paying for?
Yeah, we have all the raw data, so you can, you know, correlate that back to your SLAs, and we also get alerting as well, which kind of ties into the second part of it, which is like the visibility. Mm-hmm. So for visibility, you know, we provide, you know, day zero to day two visibility for these SD-WANs.
Okay, what is day two? That's not a term I'm familiar with.
Okay, so day zero is pre-deployment, you know, just understanding your network, WAN, and where you might deploy SD-WAN as a, you know, proof of concept initially. Day one is actually when you deploy those SD-WAN technologies, see how it's working. And day two is really operational. So that's kind of how we define it, is once you have everything running operationally, you know, how is that working in terms of, you know, alerting if there's an issue, the usual reporting, workflows to do WAN capacity analysis, and then, like I mentioned, the service provider performance analysis as well. So that's day two for us.
Okay. You mentioned application visibility. How are you getting that visibility? What kind of granularity can you get on the kinds of applications I'm running on my network?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the SD-WAN vendors, but typically they use some type of DPI. Cisco's well known with the NBAR2. And using that information, we collect it. And it varies from SD-WAN vendor to SD-WAN vendor, which is kind of interesting. So for the Cisco devices, we can get that through IPFIX and AVC and Perfmon and things of that sort. So it's through NetFlow, which makes it very easy. Other SD-WAN vendors use REST APIs or other combinations as well. So it's a bit of work for us, but you know, we have to understand, you know, what the controller is giving us and then correlate that back. And then that kind of ties back to the performance data, like I mentioned. So once we get the application data correlated back to the performance, because the SD-WAN vendors are really using that, you know, application performance over the WAN to make routing decisions to improve that route path for that particular applications.
And you also mentioned you've got historical data.
Yep, definitely. So we have a big data backend to store all the Flow and SNMP and other REST API data that we gather. So that's actually a big challenge in itself. So as our large enterprise customer in a distributed footprint, you know, how do you collect all that data? So we see a lot more adoption of IPFix / NetFlow from our customers. So, you know, the value prop is really, you know, do you do packets or flow? And flow is just an order of magnitude easier to like collect in terms of like the storage costs and things of that sort. So using that, we can provide a lot of historical data. People are kind of familiar with NetFlow, you know, the old NetFlow V5. But today, NetFlow can export so much more information. Like we can get SD-WAN controller performance information through IPFix. So it's not just data plane flow information. We can get control information as well.
Okay. And do you have a sense of how much data you can store, how many flow records, or is that dependent on the server that people load live action onto?
Definitely dependent on the server and disk store, whether it's SSD or other. But you know, we've really optimized our backend to do that. We can clock our collection at over 1 million flows per second. And we've done that because, you know, we started all in the military space and we can monitor large networks there. And we spent a lot of time researching how to do time series database specifically for NetFlow. So we built this technology out over a decade and we can collect at scale over a distributed environment very easily for us.
Okay. So sticking with having this NetFlow data, do you have a way of allowing folks to dive into it, to search through it, to surface it up in some interesting and compelling way?
Oh yeah, definitely. So I think one of the things that we're really well known for is our visualization. So we have 4 patents in this area, but we can do very granular visibility in terms of like showing exactly what the topology looks like overlaid with NetFlow. So that's one of our key selling points, but we can also do that like as a DVR function. So you can go back, you know, a week, a month, and say, show me what the topology looked like, and then show me all the flows that are going across that network at that time. So, you know, people use it for forensic purposes or like application performance purposes.
Right, right.
But having that raw data is like really key for our customers. But, you know, it's really hard for them to do with a packet, but with flow, it's so much easier.
You also mentioned the third value proposition being scale, and you also talked about being able to do very large environments. Can you give me an example of the size you're talking about?
We work with, you know, our customers are some of the largest retailers, global services companies, energy companies that use our product. So they have thousands of sites, and typically it's a global footprint and multiple data centers across the world. And you can imagine like managing a WAN like that is very difficult. So SD-WAN is a natural fit for a lot of these companies. So for us, you know, being able to work in those large environments and be able to the deployment portion of it, the scale is very key. So some of these retailers have, you know, retail branches all across the world, but they need connectivity and each branch could potentially have multiple connections, right? So when you multiply that out, the complexity kind of grows. So having a platform that can, you know, really see into that becomes very important.
And what about then that sort of fabled single pane of glass? Do you have a mechanism to get a big picture on this if you're working with a very large network and a distributed network?
Yeah. So once we got through the challenge of being able to see a distributed collection and across all your enterprise network, bringing that back, we can actually show a single pane of glass. So from each of the collection points, we can build out the topology and then the flow. So you're really getting, you know, a single view, not just across the SD-WAN, but into your campus and other portions of the network. But one of the problems is at that scale, it becomes really hard to understand certain things and patterns. So one of the things that we're working on is things like machine learning.
Mm-hmm. What do you anticipate will come down the line with machine learning? I know that's an area that's getting a lot of attention, and I'm always curious what particularly you mean by machine learning and what kind of value you think it's going to bring.
It's really looking for various patterns, and it's interesting because on the SD-WAN side, you know, we can look at the raw metrics and in a vendor-neutral fashion, you know, look at, you know, if there's certain patterns that are unusual. And we built certain models for different things. Like we built a model for on an application basis on a per branch site, you know, is the behavior interesting or different? And also we could do like route changes. Is this application changing routes and why is that? But one of the things that we do differently is this concept of human in the loop, meaning we can alert you using machine learning, but we still need feedback from the operator to tell us, you know, are we on the right track or not?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when the operator tells us this, it actually enhances our model. So we definitely see that as a key differentiator.
It's nice to hear there's still a place for people.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So if folks are interested in live action, they want to get more information, where should they go?
Liveaction.com will provide you all the information. We got tons of videos and white papers, so that should be a good starting point.
Fantastic. All right, folks, head on over to liveaction.com if you want to find out more about what we've been talking about today. And this wraps up our conversation. John, thanks for joining us, and thanks again to Live Action for sponsoring this coffee talk. You can find more fine, free technical podcasts at packetpushers.net. And while you're there, sign up for our free membership program, which includes the link propagation and human infrastructure newsletters. For more details, head on over to packetpushers.net/members. Thanks for listening. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.